Let me just start by talking about my official visit to Australia, which some of you will be joining me on. I leave tomorrow afternoon for a five-day visit, which includes stops in Melbourne, Canberra and Sydney. I'll have a bilateral talks with Prime Minister Kevin Rudd in Canberra on Thursday. And I can also announce today that there will be a historic joint cabinet meeting of New Zealand and Australian ministers in Sydney on Friday. Seven of my cabinet colleagues will join me at this meeting. The Australians will have a similar number of ministers as well as Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. This will be the first time such a large contingent of ministers from both sides of the Tasman have met as a group to discuss issues that both governments have a common interest in. The meeting underlines the close partnership our two countries have, and Australia, without saying the obvious, is our most important relationship. Our countries are linked economically and financially in so many other ways too. There are defence and security links, business links, education links, science and innovation links, not to mention the people-to-people and family links that make our countries as close as they are. As a full official visit, my trip to Australia is a departure from the normal annual meeting between myself and my counterpart. It is a privilege for any leader to make an official visit to another country, and these meetings set the tone and direction of the relationship. There is a strong economic focus to my visit. I'll spend time with business people in Melbourne and Sydney, including New Zealand investors in Australia, and I'll also attend a tourism-related event in Sydney. There will be a lot to talk about with Kevin Rudd in Canberra. We will discuss regional and international issues, as well as review progress in expanding the bilateral relationship following on from our meeting in March. As I previously flagged, there is likely to be an announcement relating to the streamlining of trans-Tasman travel, and also possibly some progress in other areas to strengthen the relationship. I very much look forward to the trip. I'll return to New Zealand on Sunday afternoon, following what will hopefully be a wonderful All Black victory in the Blairsville Cup in Sydney on Saturday night. I want to give you an update on the Youth Opportunities Package. You will recall that the Youth Opportunities Package announced by me at the National Party Conference on the 2nd of August. I have an update on the numbers of jobs employers have offered under the Job Ops Scheme, which offers a $5,000 wage subsidy over 6 months. I'm pleased to say the response so far has been very pleasing. In 2 weeks, up until Friday of last week, there have been nearly 400 jobs offered by employers for young people to take up under the scheme. The actual number, to be precise, is 398. The breakdown has retail trade leading with 72 positions, followed closely by agriculture, forestry and fishing jobs, accommodation, cafes and restaurants, and manufacturing. As of Friday, there were a total of 38 registrations of interest in the Community Max scheme, which subsidises a young person's wages at the minimum wage of $30 a week, 30 hours a week, for 26 weeks to undertake work identified by communities and useful community projects. I would note here that we don't know how many job opportunities Community Max has generated yet, given that these proposals are more complex than, say, an employer offering to take on one or two young people. I would also expect further details on the job impact of Community Max further down the track. Overall, I'm very heartened by the response so far to the Job Ops scheme and the Community Max scheme, which makes up two parts of the Youth Opportunities Package. I just want to draw your attention next, if I can, to a joint announcement today from Bill English and Rodney Hyde on red tape. This is another outcome from the Job Summit. Reducing red tape and compliance costs was one of the top 20 recommendations to come out of it. Although it is a subject that can be a bit dry to some people, it's really important to helping business get on with what they do best, which is investing to produce goods and services and employing people. In this time of recession, the government is focused on doing all it can to help businesses get through the worst part and move into recovery mode. I invite you to look at the detail of today's announcement, which includes two key commitments. Firstly, to introduce new regulations only when the government is satisfied that it is required, reasonable and robust. And secondly, to review existing regulations and identify and remove requirements that are unnecessary, ineffective and excessively costly. You will, of course, be aware that the House resumes this week. In fact, it resumes tomorrow. It is the government's intention to complete the estimates debate and progress first readings of bills on the order paper. Wednesday, the 19th of August, will be a Members' Day. And really, at that point, maybe I'll just open up for questions.
Just outline what this historic cabinet meeting will entail. Are we actually talking about an agenda, a sit-down meeting between the two sides, or is it more informal?
A formal sit-down meeting. There is an agenda. It'll start with opening remarks by Kevin Rudd and myself. Then it'll open to the individual ministers to talk about items that are on the agenda. Hopefully there'll be a free-flowing engagement and discussion about issues that are of joint interest, and I'd anticipate a communique released at the end of it, which would spell out the work programme that the ministers will start working on over the next few months.
Can it be described as a joint cabinet when there's only seven from either side?
Yeah, well, look, it's certainly the largest historic meeting. That's the way it's been characterised by the Australians, and we would concur with that view. It's not in the strictest sense of the word a cabinet meeting in the way that we have, you know, cabinet secretary and the likes, but it is the nearest thing you're going to get to that on an Australasian basis.
Can you give us an idea of what issues will be on?
It's wide range. I mean, there's everything from education to science and innovation, some of the harmonisation and business and trade issues. There'll be bound to be a discussion about defence issues that we both face, foreign affairs, and of course, our role in the Pacific. Maybe some discussion about Afghanistan. There'll certainly be a discussion about economic issues and, of course, tourism, which both countries are very interested in.
On the Pacific Forum trip, you signalled that an announcement might be made around the Overseas Investment Act and a favourable deal for Australia. Can we expect some details this week?
Yeah, I think it's likely that issue will be progressed. It's still a matter of debate between myself and Kevin Rudd, but certainly one of the things that will be on the agenda as I sit down and have a discussion with him, and I'm hopeful that a new threshold can be agreed and communicated to you on the trip.
There were some reports out of Australian media at the weekend that seemed to indicate that New Zealand and Australia were essentially going to move to a domestic arrangement for flights between two countries. Actually, aircraft arriving at domestic terminals, no more departure taxes, nothing mentioned. Does that have any validity, those flights?
No, I don't think they do have validity. I've seen the comments in The Age, and I think they are incorrect. There still will be a departure tax. I mean, departure taxes are applied for a variety of reasons, but aviation security charges, all sorts of costs of compliance. Secondly, it's not my expectation that planes will fly into domestic airports. That is something that officials look closely at, but in the end, that for a variety of reasons, that wasn't progressed. Partly because it doesn't always work. You know, you end up with a plane in a domestic terminal that you actually want to fly internationally. There are biosecurity issues that need to be progressed. So for a variety of reasons, we decided that wasn't the right way to go. But you know, what I think you will see is a domestic-like experience, and one that is a sensible step that will encourage people, hopefully, to travel across the Tasman. It certainly will speed up the process. And last week, I took the opportunity to go through Auckland Airport and look at a number of things they're doing there, but also get a sense of the look and feel of what it will be like, hopefully when we can make the announcement on Thursday. And I can tell you that they're working very hard on speeding up the process, and there's real deliverables there that should see people be able to get off the Trans-Tasman flight and progress very quickly out the other end.
Both ends,
yeah.
Prime Minister Trevor Millard has criticised the judge of the Janet Moses exorcism case, saying that if they were Pākehā, then the group would have gone to jail.
Yeah.
What's your view on that?
Well, I don't agree with those comments from Trevor Millard. And it's my view that the judge needs, in determining what sentence is appropriate, to look at a number of factors. A custodial sentence, you know, is always an option, but I would argue is one that should be applied by a judge where they think it's in the best interest of the community and the taxpayer at large. You know, I note the comments from Trip Mallard. He said, to quote him, I accept that they almost certainly would not reoffend, and prison may be an expensive waste of time. Well, if that is his assessment, why would we send someone to prison? Now, it's my view that this is a tragic set of circumstances. I think that the intent of those the people that came before the judge was not to kill the person. I think they were misguided. I think it's gone terribly wrong. But I don't think this is a racial issue.
Are you relaxed about politicians yet again commenting on a case that now has been closed in the courts?
Well, generally, that's bad practice. And as a general rule, I wouldn't comment on it. And the only reason I am is because I'm really reacting to the comments made by Trevor Mallard. But as a general rule, I think politicians should stay away from critiquing the custodial cell or the sentences that judges believe to be appropriate.
There's the health report out yesterday. What do you make of this recommendation for a body that would essentially decide what services are provided in the public health system?
Well, it's an idea worthy of consideration. I think the Health Minister made it quite clear yesterday when he was talking about the paper that will now go to consultation over the next 2 or 3 months. We'll have an opportunity for the wider health sector to express their views. I think some ideas will be accepted, some will ultimately be rejected. But what I do know is that we campaign very strongly on moving resources from the back office to the front office, that we absolutely are going to need to deliver greater efficiency and productivity in the health sector, and therefore we need to take seriously suggestions that could deliver that, and this is one that might do, along with the sort of the bulked up purchasing arrangement for IT and payroll and the likes.
This also talks the report about you know, basically deciding which new treatments or interventions would come into the public health system. It also talks, though, about carving out some of those that are already there. Do you accept that some people might fear that this is a framework for rationing or for cuts?
Well, I don't think they should have that fear. The whole purpose of this review is to deliver more resources to the front line and greater efficiency. So in my view, that's our goal. Let's see what the sector thinks about it.
Prime Minister, do you have confidence in your National Party President?
I do, yes.
Do you think he's the safe pair of hands that you declared him to be when he was elected?
I do, yes.
With the youth opportunity jobs, why do you think there were so many in the first two?
Well, I think it's an expression of a couple of things, a support for young people and wanting to see them in work. So I think the ambitions of employers is aligned with that of the government. And secondly, I think it's a good deal. At the end of the day, this is an opportunity to take on a young person for 6 months, to have the bulk of their wages subsidised, and a good opportunity to give that young person a chance in life. And I'd encourage more employers to access the program. And I'd love to see the program oversubscribed. That would be a very positive outcome.
How many are you anticipating people will sign up for this over the year now?
Well, I think it was 4,000 we indicated from memory over the 18-month period. Look, there may be more. If there is more, that's something the Cabinet would consider because that would be a positive result.
I
think
this discussion's going over.
What New Zealand's doing to help the salvage operation in Tonga.
Yeah, so firstly, we have been working in daily contact with the Tongan government, primarily with the committee established under Bill Tungi, the Deputy Prime Minister. We've been in daily contact with them. On Friday, I received a report through the CDF, effectively by the head of the Navy, which detailed that neither New Zealand nor Australia have a military capability to salvage this ship. As we understand, it's in 110 metres of water, and the extent of our capability is 60 metres. The Minister of Foreign Affairs has also sought advice on what private sector capability there may or not may not be to salvage this ship, including in industries like the oil and gas industry. We anticipate some feedback on that before I leave for Australia. But I guess I would hasten to add that we have no idea whether either that capability is there or at what time frame or what cost that would be. And I am of the view that we do need to make sure that in considering all of our options, we also consider the future of Tongans, and it may be that the best use of resources is in assisting Tonga to purchase a new ship that can make sure that the future travel is safe. So we need to weigh up all of those factors.
So you're saying it's an either-or option, not a
Well, it would depend enormously on what the cost and capability is.
So what cost is unacceptable?
I don't know at this stage. Let's wait to see the report. But hopefully I'll have some advice on that by tomorrow.
And what's happened in terms of fixing a new ship?
Again, they're in daily contact talking to the Tongans about their requirements, and the Ministry has been working with the private sector to try and look at what alternatives are available. I think hopefully we can have a successful conclusion of that quite quickly. That's certainly our aim. The only other thing I would say is that there's obviously been a Royal Commission inquiry established. New Zealand will offer whatever support the Tongan government wants for that Royal Commission of Inquiry to ensure that it can go about its work and give accurate and accurate answers to the questions that it poses.
Prime Minister, are there any discussions going on with the United States at the moment about a potential ship visit?
No.
Not even speculation of Coast Guard or something like that?
Oh, look, you know, from time to time, that always is something that you hear people talk about, but as far as I'm aware, there's been no formal or informal request of a ship visit.
On the issue of beneficiaries, were you surprised that more than 300 people claimed
$1,000 a week? I was a little surprised when I first heard that number from the Minister a few weeks ago, because she obviously raised it in response to the previous issue. Yeah, I think she is doing the right thing in auditing the facts behind those individual cases. This is a situation where I think taxpayers have to feel confident the system is providing the necessary support, but also value for money and a degree of fairness, because at $1,000 a week plus, that is more than the average wage. I would just hasten to add one final point, and that is that the release of that information came because the Labor Party asked us a parliamentary question, and we were required to answer that parliamentary question. It's not something we sought to put in the public domain.
The argument is that some of these people have a lot of children and
That's
really
right.
rely on this income. Do you think it's unfair just to focus on these few?
Well, I think, in the first instance, let's just see exactly whether all of that has been claimed is appropriate and is fair. I can't comment that. I just comment on what I know from MSD, which is there are over 300 getting $1,000 a week or more.
Do you have any doubts about those entitlements? I mean, if there's that much money going to them, you think that the party would be keeping a pretty close eye on it?
Well, I'm not sure when or if they have been reviewed. I guess that's for the Minister to determine. So she feels that it's necessary to have a bit of a look, and she's doing that.
The group that raised concerns that the government may be considering changing the entitlements for access to benefits. The government have any plans on those lines?
No, that's not our intention at this point.
Just going back to the Auckland Board for a moment, if the motivation is to shift resources from the Akron to the front line, can each DHB be reassured that any savings identified will be spent within their DHB rather than captured?
Well, it's too early, I think, to answer that question. I mean, we're undertaking a review process, and having put together a task force to come up with recommendations, that's now going for consultation. Now, that's the sort of question that I guess will be answered. What happens to savings? How will that work? What I can tell you at the moment is a lot of those DHBs are facing quite significant deficits, so maybe some will be applied to that. But look, at this point, it's just too early to tell.
I guess the point is to be reassured this isn't a cost-cutting exercise. If the health system is reassured that the money is going to be re-spent on frontline services.
Well, it's certainly not a cost-cutting exercise in so much that we are spending more on health than any previous government ever has, and it's sucked up over 50% of our new budget spending in the last budget. What we do know is that as a government, we've allocated a smaller new budget spending component in the years ahead. That means that we are going to ultimately have to make do in these big departments with a smaller growth than they have experienced in the last 9 or 10 years. And that is a function of a government that is simply running very large deficits and taxing people less. Now, there's more money going in, but we're going to have to drive efficiency. And I think we all recognise that when it comes to health, it's one of the few areas where technology drives demand, both for new drugs and for new procedures. And New Zealanders want a first-class, they're going to have that first order system, then we're going to have to deliver more efficiencies in the back office so that we can grow our resources on the front line.
Just one thing to note about the new technologies and the new procedures. I mean, their report also talks about limiting in any given year in the budget how much can be spent on new interventions. Is that something you could support?
Well, look, you know, again, that's something that needs to be canvassed with the health sector. I don't think I'm in a position to answer that today.
If you made the head for the restructuring that's recommended in the report, do you consider that to be a breach of your election commitment not to restructure the health services in a significant way? Or the Powell's made that campaign?
Yeah, I don't think I would accept that view, in that we campaigned on not major restructuring. The reason we did that was this is a sector that's had a lot of restructuring, and we acknowledge that. And secondly, we want the focus of attention to be on how to deliver better outcomes, not a focus that's solely on the structure of the health system. But you know, the proposal that is on the table at the moment is still to keep the 21 DHBs. Now, I accept that you know, there would be a high degree of collaboration, enforced collaboration, in some of the back office areas. But I think in principle, we would still be honouring our commitment.
The principles of Auckland Grammar and
Well, look, I think the bigger issue here is that we need to be strong in our view that there's no place for violence in sport, whether it's professional sport or at a schoolboy level. I think it brings the game into disrepute. I think it discourages people from being active in sport. And it's the wrong message to youngsters who we want to encourage to be active in sport and not be getting themselves in trouble. And this kind of semi-mass violence by a football field has got no place in New Zealand sport.
Prime Minister, have you received Professor Gluckman's report in the methamphetamine?
Yes, I have.
Have you had a chance to look at details of it?
Yes, I have.
Just on the matter of banning pseudoephedrine from cold and flu tablets, does it look like that could be possible?
Well, that is a recommendation he makes in the report. He makes a number of or presents a number of alternatives and makes a number of draws a number of conclusions. I don't want to go into detail on that today, primarily because I'm working on a number of other initiatives in the wider drugs debate. And it would be my intention to both release that report and my recommendations in the foreseeable future.
So he has recommended banning pseudoephedrine?
He's recommended a number of potential options. One of those is to potentially ban pseudoephedrine in terms of over-the-counter and for non-hospital medication. That's one option he's presented. He's presented a number of alternatives.
So he said to you, look, that's possible, you could do this.
He said there's a range of options available to you and you might want to consider which one you want to adopt.
So it's obviously not sort of completely ruled out and you know it wouldn't cause too much hardship to the public to be without pseudoephedrine and over-the-counter tablets.
Well, I don't want to go into the details of his findings. I'd rather release the report in totality to you and I'll do that in due course, but I'm just considering a couple of other component parts to it this time. I can't tell you exactly when I'll release the report, but it's in the foreseeable future.
What else does he recommend?
But I'll go into that today.
So does that effectively mean that those prescriptions or those medicines would become prescription medicines?
If that was the preferred outcome, if that was the process that the government adopted, as I said, there's a number of alternatives presented.
Looking at the regulatory frameworks between Australia and New Zealand, which may be on the agenda when you meet later this week, currently Australia criminalises cartel behaviour and New Zealand doesn't. Can we afford to be, given the realities of the Australian market, can we afford to be out of step with the Australians on such an issue?
Look, I think that is a legitimate issue for New Zealand to consider. You know, it falls into where the differences currently lie between the New Zealand Commerce Commission and the ACCC in Australia. I haven't seen any advice on that, so I can't comment in detail on it, but it is something that ministers could consider.
Because we wouldn't want to be seen as the soft touch when it comes to cartel behaviour.
And partly depends on resources in different industries. There's a number of different factors to consider, but certainly differences between the ACCC and the New Zealand Commerce Commission is something that I know the Commerce Minister is considering.
Are we, you know, getting towards political union, do you think, eventually?
No. Am I likely to become Prime Minister of Australia? Very unlikely. But nor are we likely to become a state of Australia. But yeah, look, it's a very significant relationship. It's a massive economic relationship. CER's been a tremendous success. And I think if you just take a step back, notwithstanding, there are always challenges along the way. A single economic market opens up a potentially domestic type constituency of 26 million people versus four. Now, you always have to consider the benefits. Sometimes there are trade-offs. In accepting that harmonisation of that market. But I think as a general rule, it serves New Zealand well where we're harmonised.
When do you expect to get the report from the ministerial accommodation?
My expectation would be within a week, maybe the outlier, I suppose, 2 weeks. But you know, hopefully I'll be in a position to talk to you about it next week. Thank you very much.